This is CliffCentral.com.
It's always nice to have a return champion on the show, and we've got one in the form of Adriana Marais, who was here before. We spoke to her about her, hopefully, her future plans to go to Mars. She's one of those either crazy or brave people, depending on your point of view, who wants to do interesting things in space and wants to be one of those people who helps take us to the next frontier, whatever shape, way or form that might come in. And she's back this year. She's in Johannesburg, actually, to speak at the Singularity University South Africa Summit, which happened last week at Kyalami Grand Prix Circuit. And it was apparently very well attended, and you had a sell-out crowd. Is that right?
Yeah, it was sold out a few days before, I think. And nice. What a enthusiastic and the crowd stayed. The seats were filled the whole way through the event. So it was really
terrific,
hugely energetic.
Yeah, well done. It's nice to be a speaker at these events. You get to meet the other speakers. You get to wow the crowd with your own stories and your own experiences. And it must have been fun.
Yeah, the chats in the speaker's room and behind the scenes, especially with the organizing team from Manmade Media, did a fantastic job of pulling it all together in the sort of 4 months that they had to prepare for it. yeah, and chatting to the other speakers was absolutely awesome.
Who did you meet? Who were the most interesting people to you?
Well, let's say they were all
she's got a whole schedule here.
So, yeah, I think I can't actually single out any unless I mention all of them because, well, let me say that Dr. Dan Barry, who shared my session, is an astronaut. So
wow.
You can tell from the titles of our talks, mine's The Allure of the Unknown and his is Sensations of Space. So
wow.
I'm talking about the
Did you fangirl a little bit?
Yeah, well, we had a great chat about how to inspire kind of space industry prior to going to Mars and things like that. So I can tell you more about that.
Okay, so let's start with that because I do remember we had quite a good and in-depth and very, very interesting conversation about precisely that Mars One project that we spoke about last time you were here. Here we are a little further down the track. Are there any sure signs, any tangible signs of progress on that front?
Well, we're still gearing up for the next selection round.
Uh-huh.
So that may be a similar thing
that
I said last year.
What does that involve that we don't know about?
So there are 100 of us in the final round, same as last year. And we're still trying to secure the deal with the broadcaster that would film episode 1, which will be narrowing down to 40, episode 2 down to 24. And this is quite an important deal because the same production company would be broadcasting this the whole way through. So the 10 years of training, the launch, the living, etc. So
now, a very cynical friend of mine said to me, oh, this Mars One thing is such bullshit. There's nothing happening. It's a scam. It's really just a way of getting people to take note of it. It's more of a media thing than anything else. And I went on and Googled it, and there are a couple of sites that kind of, I don't know whether they're credible or not, but they seem to intimate that the whole thing is actually never going to happen. I mean, do you read that crap?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let's first get things straight. There's no guarantee that this happens at all. So
no,
in that
sure.
sense, they would be perfectly correct.
Yeah.
Will we manage to, for the first time in the 4 billion years of the evolution on life, build a rocket and go and live on another planet? Who knows?
But
we've never done it before.
For you, it's worth the gamble because you would rather be excited and it doesn't happen than not be excited and it never happens.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of people say, how is this solving problems on Earth, you know, spending all this money on space exploration? I'm like, how is not going to Mars helping us solve our problems on Earth? Because I don't see any progress there.
Yeah.
And this may well be one of the important contributions towards
the shift in
perspective.
A lot of smart people have said, who knows what terrific new innovation or progress of thought or ideas might come from something that is intended to get us to Mars that might have real benefits on Earth. There are so many things that came out of the moon program in the 60s that we can now consider part of our everyday lives that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for that. You have to keep pushing, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't even say may come out. I would say definitely will. I mean, I don't think there's any example of people having pushed the boundaries in any aspect of art, science, whatever field you name it, of people having pushed boundaries and come to new, fresh conclusions. So yes, the Apollo missions in the 60s and 70s, purely through the inspiration of having watched those, men all in those days achieving that, resulted in a spike in the number of students enrolling in STEM STEM degrees. And what did we have in the 80s? The development of the mobile phone, the personal computer, the internet. These were all technologies that came as a result of inspiration only. So never mind the technological developments that I think we'll be forced to obviously make in order to survive the conditions on Mars, for example. I think the level of inspiration that people may feel from watching us try to do that could even be enough to have some revolutionary technologies emerging.
Well, you're not just sitting on your hands waiting for Mars 1 to happen, because you've been very busy. You are, as we introduced last time, you're a theoretical physicist by degree, but you're also head of innovation at SAP and aspiring extraterrestrial is what they say on the CV. Is that right?
Yeah. Trying to get off the planet.
It's a lot. You're antisocial. Just admit it. You're tired of humans.
It is kind of busy on this planet, yeah.
Did you watch that movie on what's it called, Arrival?
Yes, that was great, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in
pretty
the beginning
cool.
I wasn't sure how it would turn out, but I loved it, yeah.
Well, for a change, it didn't turn out with everyone trying to kill each other.
Yes.
Which is usually a good outcome, especially when you're dealing with aliens who may have sophisticated technologies. But do you find yourself caught up in a lot of that sci-fi stuff just because it's so close to what you are studying and you care about? And it's almost a window into other people's imagination of what could be.
Yeah, definitely. I think this has been said before, but that gap between science fiction and science reality is ever narrowing. And indeed, I think the things that we were watching decades ago are now exist,
well,
and the things we're watching in movies
someone
now
said to
will
me,
exist.
Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek, which I was never really the biggest fan of, but things like the iPad were first visualized in that form on shows like that. Now we take them for granted. They're everywhere.
Yeah, and so the first satellite, for example, was written in Russian science fiction. So I think we can find correlations between what people have dreamed up and then what people have later developed, and maybe as a result of reading those science fiction books as kids.
You almost manifest the innovation, right?
Yeah, or perhaps when you have a collective learning, there are some points along the way on the journey that will be covered, whether you're just dreaming about them or whether you're making them a reality.
What was it that made you want to get into science, theoretical physics, for God's sake?
It was the hardest thing in the university manual because I couldn't understand any of the descriptions of the courses. And I thought, well, if I'm going to waste my time at university every day when I could be at the beach, I'd just move to Cape Town. Then I will make it worth my while.
Well, theoretical physics is complex. And I've tried to read A Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking's book. I've tried to read it 4 or 5 times. I don't know that I emerge any smarter every time. I keep trying though. How do you get ideas like space-time and black holes and the event horizon and matter and antimatter? How do you get these things clear in your head? Because a lot of them are so complex and so full of things that are difficult to visualize that we can't use our senses always to interpret.
So a lot of time, I think, and that's a contrast I'm finding now between working as a theoretical physics researcher and in my new position in innovation at SAP, is that I feel like in the current society in which we live, we don't spend enough time thinking. We live fast-paced lives. We have very little time to reflect over the emails we send, over the meetings we have, mm-hmm. and the whole direction of our day-to-day activities. And I get a bit worried about this sometimes because a day in the life of a theoretical physicist researcher could be reading the same page 30 times.
That's it. Right.
And struggling over starting a calculation, which you don't necessarily complete. Of course, the other days when you're very busy, then when you figure out what's going on. But I think the time taken to consider the way forward or even reflecting on the way that on the past is extremely important for making sure that we're not just rushing to keep up with various things and we haven't thought about why. So I think that can also be used to describe technology. I mean, it's often seen that we're riding this wave of technology, desperately trying to keep up with the developments that are happening around us. Then we run the risk of running up in a reality that we little imagined when we started off with this busyness. I think reflection is extremely important. And I think we need to remember that we are the creators of this technology. We are the creators of this momentum.
Not the other way around.
And, yeah. this is wonderful to talk about exponential technologies and exponential possibilities, but the reality is that in an exponential growth cycle, the initial conditions are hugely important. If you start with a subtly different set of initial conditions, you can be catapulted off into a very different future than the one you imagined. So I think we need to carefully think about where we are and where we're going at every point in the road.
And also on that exponential curve, if you do start going in a direction after that curve has taken off, accelerated in an upward direction, if you do suddenly discover that this is not a direction you want to be in, it's very hard to change it at that point.
Definitely.
And sometimes dangerous.
Yeah, which could be good or scary.
So teach me a little bit of theoretical physics, because I'd like to understand things like, for example, this idea of what constitutes the universe, why there's so much of nothing. You know, to me, these are complex things that are very difficult to understand. But for a theoretical physicist, you have to grasp them early on.
Yeah, so I'd say probably people doing theoretical physics have just spent a lot more time thinking about these things and aren't any special kind of humans or anything.
Well, they are, because you're dealing with really, really smart people.
They just have the patience, I suppose.
Is that it? I mean, do you get a feeling of satisfaction and achievement when you've completed a calculation?
Yeah, definitely. Because it's so difficult, I suppose. Some of my textbooks had blood on some of the pages, for example.
Jesus.
From chewing my nails, right? Yeah. Just an aside.
What kind of pressure is that?
Well, the intellectual challenge of not figuring it out and knowing that it's logical because it's in the textbook, so presumably it's been vetoed by several people.
Do you ever feel that sense of imposter syndrome? Like, what am I doing here?
Always. I think that's normal. Yeah.
Apparently the brightest people in the world have felt that way, so you shouldn't be in bad company then. All right. So what for you has been the most difficult concept to try and figure out, to get your head around?
Gosh, all of it. I think I love it. I think once I'm reaching the point of sharing something with you, that means I've kind of embraced it to some extent. Yeah. So I wouldn't look back and say it was difficult. I'd say the reward of knowing that was great.
Okay. So give me an example.
Well, let's talk about the origins of the universe, because actually I have something here that I wanted to show you.
What is that? What do you got in there?
So this is a present, the most extraordinary gift I've ever received, from Professor Francis Thackeray.
Yes.
And he has given me, and let me open it up. And I've brought the real thing today, even though it's audio. This is a piece of Mars. It's small, so don't get your hopes up.
Oh, wow.
It's a tiny little piece of the planet Mars.
I totally get why this is the best gift you've ever received. This is phenomenal.
It mostly stays in the cupboard at home, but I took it out. I took it out for the Singularity University.
How did they bring this back?
So this landed in Libya, and was found in 1998.
And they've analyzed it and decided it came from Mars.
Yeah. So the isotopic ratios in the rock, especially the air bubbles, and the isotopic ratios in the air bubbles show us that this not only is not from Earth, in terms of those ratios, but correlates very well with what we've detected to be the atmosphere on Mars with the Curiosity rover and other remote sort of laboratories that we have there. And so we know that it fell from Mars. So I had a lot of questions at the SU event on how it got here. So researchers in astrophysics and stuff could correct me, but I think the two possible mechanisms are getting exploded from a volcano, basically. So on Mars, we have
ejection.
A 20 ejection. That's what I was looking for. So it could have come from the highest volcano in the solar system, the Olympus Mons, 24 kilometers high. Or during an impact on Mars, a large impact, obviously, when debris was sort of scattered off the planet, that could have been another option for meteorites or interplanetary meteoritic exchange. So the possibility that, given that we know Mars had a lot of liquid water on the surface, or at least liquid water on the surface billions of years ago, this could have been a mechanism by which some microbes, bacteria, some kind of organisms were brought to Earth. Because right here is a physical example of
isn't that a fascinating idea? I mean, I think a lot of people imagine that Earth is super special and that we are very lucky to exist. And of course, the chances of this particular Goldilocks zone planet, and the fact that we have a climate, and we have an atmosphere, and we have liquid water, and all of those things are essential for life to have begun here. But the idea, and it's becoming increasingly credible among scientists, that maybe that bacterial life was perhaps generated somewhere else and then made its way here, and that we're actually all aliens.
Yeah, some more than others.
It's quite a sexy thought, right? I mean, that maybe we're actually all Martians, and we've just adapted to life on Earth.
Definitely. So that brings me back to the topic of the origins of the universe. So, I mean, the chemistry that was required for life emerged pretty soon after the Big Bang. Okay. So the Big Bang is just the mainstream theory that we have for how the universe began.
It's actually a pejorative term. Big Bang was used by people who didn't think that was possible. And it became almost like the N-word that was appropriated by scientists who then used it as the colloquial term for what might have been at the origin of the universe, the singularity, the idea that there was this sudden, you know, massive, massive pressure and temperature explosion, just unlike anything that ever happened. And from that everything developed and in a very, as you say, short space of time, that those conditions were laid down.
So that's the fun part about science, I suppose. You can propose any kind of theory, and as long as no one finds evidence against it, your theory will prevail. So whether it was done always, in jest or not,
but everyone's working all the time to disprove.
False, yes.
Yeah. So you actually, this peer review mechanism is probably one of the best ways. It's a scientific method, but the best ways of establishing what is true.
And so far, that seems to be the way that the universe did emerge, according to the evidence we've gathered so far, of a time very long ago, and of a space that we have a bit of evidence for. So, I mean, the atoms that were created during the Big Bang included hydrogen and helium, but the rest of the periodic table required huge amounts of energy that were generated in supernova events to be created. So then we saw the periodic table having been formed in the whole array of atoms that we see around us now. Fairly soon, don't want to be quoted on this, but less than a billion years after the Big Bang began, the chemistry that would have been necessary for life already existed. So it's possible that we have organisms out there with 10 billion years of evolution on us. So, I mean, if we look at generation gaps or whatever over a period of 30 years.
This is where people say that it's almost an idiot's game to predict that there isn't at least some other kind of evolved life somewhere in the universe, because the possibilities would indicate that if the potential for us to exist exists, that there must be far more.
So the question, I suppose, is then how long can an intelligent organism sustain itself for? To what extent is being intelligent kind of
and how intelligent,
self-prophesizing extension?
And how intelligent
event?
Are we actually? Because we're not that smart. If there is a species that has 10 billion years more evolution than we do, they must be super smart by comparison.
So, I mean, then we look at the speakers talking about the future of energy and so on. And then in some sense, you know, photosynthetic organisms, the precursors of all complex life on Earth that have been around 4 billion years, mm-hmm. According to the fossil record, are in some sense much more intelligent than us. They harness the only renewable energy source on planet Earth, which is sunlight. In an extremely efficient way, they use carbon dioxide, another abundant resource, and H2O, or previously H2S, now H2O in higher plants. These are the most abundant resources that you see around us, and we're only slowly moving now towards developing, for example, organic photovoltaics. Because just any solar panel that you put on your roof of your house is not necessarily making the world a better place in terms of environmental impact because of the rare metals that are required to make those things function. And then we have the mining and all of that as the mm-hmm. impact on the environment.
So all these supposedly green buildings are not necessarily doing as much good
as they the batteries,
think,
unfortunately, we're long overdue for a revolution in battery power. But that brings me then to asteroid mining, a topic I want to get to at some point in terms of where we may get these
metals. Okay, because you see this, I knew this was going to happen. You and I would get stuck down some tangential path about something that's of peculiar interest to us. But you did mention the origins of the universe. So what part of that are you most interested in? Are you interested in what happened immediately after the Big Bang with the hydrogen and later the fusion with helium that must have occurred in the event? Or is it those supernovae that came up later on where you had, you know, more complex elements being fused from hydrogen and helium? Or is it the violence of the actual event? Is it the clash of matter and antimatter that they believe happened immediately after that, where there was just a little bit more matter left over than anti? Is it in what happened in a much slower tail of that event and all the things that we would consider to be enormous cosmic events now, but that by comparison were quite muted and small? What is it that excites you about that?
So as a quantum physicist, the large-scale descriptions, which would be part of astrophysics, are not my field of expertise. But I think the interesting thing for me is how those unique molecules came about that are the precursors for life as we know it, whether there are other precursor molecules that could create systems that have characteristics of life, although that's very difficult for us to say, given that we only have one example of life, which is terrestrial life. We all share the DNA molecule in common, so we are one system to some extent, we are one living system, I would say. So to find a non-DNA-based life form, whether or not we'd be able to identify it as living, given that it's not like any life we've been used to seeing around on Earth.
What is the scientific definition then for? What are the basic requirements to be ticked off as living?
So when you look at the definition of life in a biology textbook, it reminds me of what I hated about school, to be honest, which are long lists of things with some exceptions and some categories are said not to be necessary for the definition. And that kind of thing just bothers me. And that's why I love physics, because there's not a wishy-washy definition of things with exceptions, and maybe life gets complex. And that's why we don't have a clear definition. But what I would like to see in terms of humanity understanding life would be, and this is going to be controversial, the capability to create it. So when we are able to take the carbon, the oxygen, the hydrogen, the various elements that we know compose life, and we're able to get them to self-form or somehow push them to form a living system, then I would say we've understood what is life. We've understood how it emerges, because everything else is just taking the existence of life as a precondition. We understand evolution to some extent. I mean, fields like epigenetics are shedding light on what we don't know, and I always get a bit suspicious about this junk DNA. But anyway, so we understand evolution to some extent. We're getting better at understanding genetics. But what we still really don't know is how it emerged. There is no Big Bang equivalent in terms of origin of life.
Spark. I mean, we can put all the constituent parts into a petri dish, and we can mix them all together in the right quantities, but we don't necessarily make life.
And we still don't make life. We can make amino acids. So that was where my research was ending off 2015 sometime, was in terms of the amino acids are quite not easy, but they've been made in multiple experiments around the world, so in various different conditions. And that's what's interesting. This is a fairly robust, complex molecule in terms of the processes that can form it. So you can have an early Earth atmospheric analog and put past electrical discharge through it,
but like a lightning storm. What came first, amino acids or the DNA and RNA that make them?
Amino acids make up proteins, which are necessary for life. And the nucleobases make up the DNA. So the smaller building blocks are where we're looking at first. How you create a cell membrane and things out of this is not 100% known, but the fact that these necessary building blocks of life can be formed, including nucleobases and including amino acids. This is shown in these kind of room temperature experiments that I said with the analog of Earth's early atmosphere with lightning. You can also make them on the surface of icy grains. So this is like an interstellar space analog. You take it down to 20 Kelvin, so that's like -250 degrees Celsius.
Almost absolute zero,
which is the predominant temperature in space. The little bit of extra energy there is because they're gaseous clouds with some cosmic rays and things like that. And you can also form amino acids on the surfaces of these ice grains.
Okay, so in other words, we can almost discount temperature as having to be an important aspect of this. They've pretty much done the experimentation.
Also, instead of electrical energy, these are taking in the UV energy. So you can add energy, whether it's electrical or whether it's in the form of electromagnetic radiation, and UV in the UV range. And then you can have a gas environment or a solid state icy environment. So basically the reactions that can result in these amino acids are fairly,
In other words,
which sounds good for in other words, a lot of life.
Yeah, life is pretty much a banal thing.
Well, to get those amino acids to formations and to sustain themselves indefinitely into the future, that's not known. So let's assume we have life, but how long it can exist. So in the primitive form, I'd say we know already that bacteria and so on have been around for about 4 billion years. Humans, 200,000 years, and the current trajectory that we're on doesn't bode that well for sustaining ourselves for billions of years. And I think an essential part of thinking about this, the sustaining of our organism, of our species, is looking at the big picture. And then I find it surprising that very few people know or care about the origins of the universe and life. And maybe this is just bias from a perspective of a theoretical physicist. But
people are more interested in the finale of Game of Thrones than they are in this stuff, right?
Yeah, or the Mayweather-McGregor fight, which I did stay up to watch, so sorry if I'm a bit tired.
Is that why you're tired?
Those things are great.
I was thinking you were busy sitting with complex equations and figuring out how life takes place on barren, miserable surfaces of planets that we don't even know exist. And meanwhile, you were watching Mayweather and McGregor fight.
Yeah, what I was trying to figure out is it better to stay up or wake up?
It's ridiculous. You're an embarrassment to science. Get out of my studio. So is it the life part of what space could represent that excites you? Because that's what we've mostly been talking about. Or is it the study of space? Is it the study of things beyond us, the bigger picture, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, an astrophysicist will probably disagree with me, but I feel like matter is something that you could argue we've understood to a large extent. And then, of course, there are counter arguments to that in terms of the antimatter argument.
Yeah, but I mean, we kind of know.
We're still looking for new particles at CERN,
sure, but we've observed that the proton is a true, real thing, that the electron actually exists, that atoms, as the ancient Greeks prophesized they might be, are the smallest building blocks, at least in terms of how you make matter, how things make sense on the periodic table, how they bond, how they create molecules. These things are more or less established science now. We don't need to go back, right?
We agree on that. Still other things to fill in the kind of higher energy experiments that we do push that boundary of the energetic scale in which we're investigating matter to new levels.
Well,
but we get it. A rock is a rock.
Hang on though, because this does deserve a little bit of inspection. So when we look at the subatomic particles and we start getting into whether things are waves or particles, that's where it gets very confusing for a lot of us. Because when we observe these things, we can't observe them anymore with the naked eye. There's no microscope that's powerful enough for you to be able to see quarks, right? So we have to look at what they do.
They're cool imaging techniques that we can use as an analogy, but yeah.
Right, but we can't actually ever see them. And it's highly unlikely that we will. To observe things at that level, at that microscopic size, is microscopic doesn't even work as an adjective here, but at that tiny, tiny proportion, it doesn't help to observe it, because by observing it, you change it. This is the idea of relativity in some ways, and the observer changing the nature of the article in question. That's where it gets really messy.
Yeah, messy or beautiful, depends on whether you want to do the math. Well, so for me, there's not really a contradiction there. I'm happy for things to sometimes manifest as particles and sometimes as waves. It's all written in the theory. So there's been no counterexample to quantum physics.
You don't have
physics.
To nail your colors to the mast on this or choose a side or any of that stuff. There's quite a lot of open-mindedness from the scientific community about what might exist there.
Yeah, I think just shut up and calculate is what Feynman said, and so far the calculations are not wrong.
That's
quantum electrodynamics.
Can we talk about Feynman for a second? What an incredible human being. You know, I watched a documentary about him the other day that I found, some obscure YouTube video. This guy was way ahead of his time, and he was probably one of the smartest human beings that have ever lived. And a lot of people don't even know about him. I didn't know about him until recently.
Yeah.
You don't have much to say about him.
I just remember that he did his calculations in strip clubs. That's not adding to the depth of this conversation.
Well, no, but that's an interesting aside to a life of someone who really contributed an enormous amount to what we understand about molecular and particle physics.
Yeah, so another story I remember about him is that he had a workbook at school where he did every single problem from every single textbook and then went on to beyond the syllabus that he was currently working on. And it's that level of practice, I think, rather than genius, that and maybe both are useful.
And obviously the fact that he tried to popularize science, and he used to do a lot of television stuff that helped to explain some of this physics to people.
Not typical for...
No, he did important work around the Manhattan Project, or certainly the stuff that came afterwards. And for that reason, we, I suppose, in science, owe him a great debt of gratitude. There are so many. Newton always used to say that you stand on the shoulders of giants, you know. It must be fun to be a part of that machine, even if you're just contributing one calculation or some evidence that helps to corroborate someone else's theory. That must feel to you like community in some way.
Yeah, also what I was getting to before by saying that we've almost understood inanimate matter, and I can feel my friends who are particle physicists shouting back when they hear me saying that, was what I wanted to say is that life is the phenomenon that we really don't have much idea about. So chemistry we've managed to derive pretty well from physics. We understand how atoms work, parts of the constituents of atoms as well. Then we look at groups of atoms, we look at chemical reactions, and although the calculations get extremely computationally intensive as we get to bigger molecules, and to a large extent we haven't managed to model the interaction of medium-sized molecules even at room temperature, and these calculations just become too intense for even the supercomputers that we have currently. When we get to trying to derive biology from chemistry, we have not managed to do that yet. So there's no scientific bridge, no conclusive scientific bridge between chemistry and biology. For that, we'd need to explain how biology emerged. Mm. And we have not done that. So origins of life would be one way to bridge those two, to define how a biological system occurs. Naturally, obviously, as a scientist, you would first start with the assumption that these things happen spontaneously. How did biology spontaneously emerge from chemistry, and what kind of new maths maybe do we need to describe this? Do we need a quantum computer to be able to compute these kind of huge challenging tasks? Even the interaction of a pharmaceutical drug, a small molecule, with a protein, we're not able to model these interactions in the liquid kind of room temperature or body temperature environment in which they happen. We're able to look at them in isolation in the ground state in a vacuum, sure, but that's really the lowest level approximation.
And there are
that we
so
have.
Many different things that can happen.
And guess what we do then? We just do trial and error. I mean, yeah. That's drug trials.
Right.
Or maybe now I'm getting interested in the possibility that machine learning could contribute to this. Maybe looking for closed form solutions that we can fit in our heads is just not going to happen. Maybe as a biological system, we don't have the brain power to even start to think about theorizing how biology emerged from chemistry. Maybe now we need to use the machines that we've developed to find correlations in the data sets that the data sets are just beyond anything that we'll be able to fit in our brains. Maybe machine learning can help us to find predictable ways to look at the interaction between molecules and proteins. I think in the healthcare industry, that's going to be hugely important, and for people like me, the curiosity of why we have this disconnect between, you know, physics and chemistry and biology would finally be answered.
Yeah, if we can establish some of these things that have been perplexing men for thousands of years, then I suppose we would feel like we'd really made a huge stride forward. But they're being made every day, little strides, right?
Yeah,
little
sure.
moves forward every day.
So, I mean, I think the common theme, and that was what was great about being at the SU event, was people from all over the world with different topics, different specializations, people really doing things. So these are not by any means people talking about things that other people have done. Yes, also. These are people really doing things, really immersed in the cutting edge results that are taking place all over the world. And I think the unity of commentary in the end was around the importance of humanity in these things. So yes, we're getting super good at building robots and understanding artificial intelligence and beginning to start to use it, I think. But the human element, is really important there. Like augmenting human intelligence will be the role of AI, according to Vivian Ming, if I understood. Looking at all of the different aspects of biotechnology and, the future of work, I think the central point of humans being the developers of these technologies.
Yeah, but we may not have to do the work one day. None of it. We may simply be sitting there and have our brain attached to some machine that then actually does the work. Or we can just program them to do it without us having to be present at all. We could spend our time painting and drawing and sculpting and thinking.
Yeah, I mean, if when I look at the future of work and people ask what I would do if I didn't have to earn money, well, exactly the same. I find it offensive to think that people think I'm doing this for the money. Of course not.
No.
I'm doing it because I love it, and I don't see any problem with machines taking over the tasks I don't want to do so that I can do what I want to do.
What is quantum cryptography? What is that all about? You did a PhD in quantum biology, but you also did this quantum cryptography. That sounds extremely arcane.
Yes, it was nice to meet Jaya Balu, who is a cybersecurity expert at the event, and she's also got an interest in quantum computing and quantum encryption, and she spoke about that in her talk. So great to have met her. So quantum cryptography is just harnessing the properties of single particles for information security.
How?
So back in 2010, this may sound like a futuristic tech or something. Back in 2010, eThekwini Municipality and the Quantum Research Group at UKZN, where I was currently a student, I as a theorist, wasn't physically involved in this implementation, but the experimentalists put the devices in the stadium, Moses Mabhida Stadium, during the 2010 World Cup, and encrypted all communications in and out of the stadium using these devices. So this is by no means a futuristic technology. It exists already.
It's already there. Yeah.
And all you need is a dedicated fiber optic connection where you send single photons to distribute the key. So as you know, you disturb a particle when you observe it. So this is a way of detecting an eavesdropper.
That's incredible. I mean, it does sound futuristic. Does this mean that instead of having IDs and instead of having to use all these various means that we have to identify people or to corroborate the evidence that they are who they say they are, that we might be able to use this kind of technology on a large scale?
Yeah, I think, well, as my opening line of my thesis said, two can keep a secret if one is dead. So this is not the holy grail of secret keeping, because the assumptions are that the two nodes who want to communicate with each other have a physically secure location. So you can break that assumption by taking a gun and breaking into the office. So right. The assumption that you have two physically secure locations is the starting point. Then you assume that the line connecting the two of you is not secure. So in the case where it's 100 kilometers or whatever, presumably you don't have the means to physically protect every centimeter of that line. And that's when you would use quantum encryption. And the point, the reason you would want to use it is, I think mostly the applications now are in government or banking, where you're not only wanting to secure your information today, but you're wanting to make sure that if someone taps into your line and records a whole lot of information that you sent today and waits for a quantum computer in 20 years, and then that, and your information you would still want to have secure in 20 years, that's the kind of use case that you're looking at for.
How can you even guarantee that? You don't know what technology might exist in 20 years.
Well, that's another point about quantum encryption, is that a quantum computer cannot break this method of encryption.
God, this is incredible. All right, I'm just looking at the CV quickly. So you also studied philosophy, which is an interesting thing to throw into the theoretical physics. I suppose that's good.
Two very
right?
related fields, I would say.
Well,
opposite sides of the campus, right. I used to get drenched running a kilometer.
Explain to me why you think they're on the same page.
Well, I think theoretical physics is philosophy just taken one step further, where you have experiments to prove your musings.
Really, you don't think that it's the one is all about thought and it's numinous and it's difficult to pin down and everybody has a different thought and all philosophies aren't necessarily in any way theoretically provable, and then on the other hand, you've got hard evidence. You think that the two are completely relatable and that you can prove philosophy with science.
No. So I think the two start from the same point, and physics adds the experimental layer on top of it, where you're able to prove or disprove theories.
But the one doesn't want to be proved and doesn't need to be proved, and the other one very much does.
No, I think philosophers do try to prove their theories, but they don't have experiments. So
talk shit to each other. Come on.
High level shit. Philosophy conferences are some of the most difficult events.
Okay, I'll give you this one. You were in Japan as an English teacher. Now, that's a fascinating country.
Yeah.
I haven't been to Japan. Yeah. Tell me about, very briefly, what you gained out of Japan.
Well, it was a bit of a normalizer, I'd say, after studying theoretical physics, thinking you're super clever and, you know, everything. And
going teaching to a country kids
where,
English.
Yeah, going to a country where you have the language capability of a 2-year-old, and then gradually maybe a 10-year-old, I'd say, by the time I left, was definitely a useful experience.
So then you come back and you do your master's in science. This is in the quantum cryptography we spoke about, and in quantum biology. Again,
yeah,
okay, this is impressive stuff. Then postdoctoral research in quantum effects in biology and the origins of probiotic molecules and life itself. And then you decide, okay, that's quite enough of the qualifying myself at university theory.
No, I think I'll be back.
Okay, but in between you decide to go corporate for a little bit. And you only joined SAP, what, in this year, 2017?
Yeah, beginning of this year.
What does your job there involve?
So officially driving digitization and across the continent and innovation, of course, in that space. So I think I feel like I can't say the L word anymore after hearing it so many times at the SU summit, but leapfrogging.
Okay.
So
did that become a swear word there?
No, we just heard quite a lot of it, and I'm not going to repeat cliches.
Okay.
But this one is true, I think, and I think we have the opportunity to look at what technologies have succeeded or failed in different parts of the world. As Africa, obviously, there's some divide between our digitization and our technological capability, and to really, I think, look at the focus of what's necessary for us here, and that's to make people's lives better. And that's the SAP motto in terms of our interaction here. What technologies can be harnessed to make people's lives better? So that's what I'm focusing on, looking in different scenarios from healthcare to data security, trying to bridge the kind of vast expanse between very cutting edge research that's going on in universities. And I think the research that goes on in universities doesn't necessarily need business, maybe in terms of funding to come up with those ideas, but I think business really does need science. I mean, the internet, for example, has enabled so much.
And to a lot of businesses, the internet's a very frightening thing.
So to the extent to which they are prepared to collaborate with science, I think needs to be improved. I think in this era of extreme development, diversity of teams in terms of understanding what's coming next is important. And I think business increasingly needs to collaborate with science to understand better what these technologies are, what they can do, and then to harness them in a business context. Because we see a lot of catchphrases being thrown around, and sometimes I worry that the depth of understanding is not there. And this is easily overcome by partnering more with, the brilliant minds and people trained in different areas coming out of science universities in South Africa. I find it really unfortunate that it's difficult to get a job sometimes. You graduate with a PhD in some obscure field, and it's difficult to get a job. So I was offered this job, and now I've had a window into the corporate world. And I think increased collaboration between science and business is essential. I see that business needs this in terms of the depth of thought that's required to really strategize, not over 6 months, which is not going to be good enough soon. I think businesses have to have a mind for 3 to 5 to even 10 years into the future if they would like to sustain themselves. And I think scientists who work at that kind of 5 to 10 year futuristic possibilities
have that built-in ability.
Yeah, that's what we do. Yeah, to publish, you have to think 5 to 10 years ahead.
So apart from watching stupid boxing and EFC fights, what else do you do for fun? I mean, you sound like the sort of person who probably has an interesting life outside of science as well. What do you do with the rest of your time?
I'm climbing Kilimanjaro. Is it next month, September?
But you're such an underachiever.
For the Santon SPCA, we're raising funds. So I'm like, we need to respect and protect life.
I hear
also,
you. You're
also
just
animals.
You're making it very difficult for people like me who just want to sit at home. You really are.
Well, that's the only holiday I'm going to get in the next few months. So looking forward to not having any signal on the mountain there. But if I could go back to the asteroids.
No,
story.
Wait, I'll get back to that in a second. Yeah. I want to ask you some things.
Yeah.
Because it must be difficult for you to have meaningless conversations, the small talk. Do you hate that? If you're stuck in a room with people who want to talk about television or, their boring relationships, does that drive you crazy?
That sounds like Facebook to me, which is why I haven't posted in about 8 months. I find it quite easy to remove myself from those kind of things.
But this is the stuff that a lot of people, this is all they do. Does that drive you mad?
No, I think life, there are lots of people on this planet. On Mars, it may not be so easy to move away from those conversations because those might be the only other people on the planet. But I think on Earth, you have only yourself to blame if you find yourself stuck in those kind of situations.
Who are your friends? I mean, who are the people you do have these fun conversations with? I'm sure you don't by any means lack a sense of humor, but who do you talk to? Like, who are the people who keep you interested?
I've got a lot of old friends, so also moving around a lot. You do make new friends along the way, obviously, but my school friends, sort of the 20-year friends, are the friends that we try to meet up with. Often we had our 20-year friendship anniversary, so most of us met in like Standard 6 in Pietermaritzburg, and now we've spread out over the country and kind of collected in Cape Town to a large extent. So when I'm down there, that's always a good chance to catch up. I've got a niece and a nephew recently, so that's exciting. Yeah. If I need children, I know where to find them.
Yeah, right. You don't have to make your own. Despite your love and your reverence for life, you don't feel the need to produce your own offspring?
No. Bizarrely or luckily.
Same here.
I don't feel that need. I feel like that's a task that's definitely being taken well care of.
There's a sustainability thing.
By the rest
thing,
of us. Yeah. And in terms of genetics, no, my niece has just turned one and my nephew's like 2 months, I think. So really excited to be watching them grow up.
All right. So you're going to take your Mars rock now and you're going to go and do some more calculations and you're going to go and work in this corporate job. And before we know it, it'll be time for a Mars expedition.
Well, so now I've decided that a necessary precursor to a crewed Mars mission and the extent to which people have called the Mars One project a joke or whatever is maybe because there's some missing steps. And having spoken to astronauts and people who've done research and actually implemented programs in NASA and ESA, etc., there are some yeah, intermediate steps that we need to achieve. And now I'm starting to become a proponent of asteroid mining as the necessary step in between what we're currently doing here on Earth. Yeah, we have a bit of space industry. We have the International Space Station and
what are we going to mine?
Plus satellites.
What are we going to find in these asteroids?
So, I mean, did you know that we have already been mining asteroids for the past few hundred years?
The ones that have landed on Earth.
The ones that have landed on Earth. Here on the Vatvardesrand, that's an asteroid that hit the Earth.
But for things like iridium, we'll only get those from stuff that's come from outer space, really. There's not a lot of iridium lying around on the Earth.
Well, I think burning fossil fuel is equivalently a not-so-intelligent way to act, as is mining out the metals that have fallen to the surface of our planet and disrupting the unique biosphere that covers the surface of the planet. The kind of rehabilitation that's required after a mine, and increasingly the legislation that prevents mining to do what it may have done in the past. I think also the depth to which mining is now being forced to be done because the low-hanging fruit has been retrieved.
So it's dangerous, and it's dangerous in a long-term respect too for the potential side effects.
And I think there's plenty of interesting developments in technology that are encompassing these challenges in terms of IoT. So having, you know, remotely capable, more autonomous mining procedures in place. So I think that removes the human risk potentially to some extent, but the environmental impact I think is still there. No matter how well you may rehabilitate it, it's time consuming and costly, of course. So mining asteroids may be just a better way, a more intelligent way of extracting those same metal deposits that we found on the surface of the Earth from where they naturally occur, which is in the asteroid belt.
So how much work would that include? I mean, that would incur some serious labor to get
so
craft
funnily enough, and in collaboration,
you can't drive a truck back from the asteroid belt.
Well, it's zero friction, zero gravity in space. It's actually quite easy to move around once you're in space. The expensive part is getting off Earth, but that's the point. We need to establish an industry off Earth. When we want to build satellites and build new international space stations, or when we want to build medical facilities in space. Dr. Dan Barry and I, he mentioned this possibility to me of having hospital-type scenarios or recovery zones where zero gravity would be beneficial to patients in space. This could be one aspect of the kind of space industry that we'd like to stimulate. Perhaps space tourism as well is another option. All of these activities would need infrastructure to be built in space, and it's going to be super expensive if we keep launching it off Earth when our resources come from space anyway. If we develop the capability to extract these asteroid resources in space and then deliver them to low Earth
orbit.
What kind
of stuff, what could we, in a big way, start mining off of asteroids?
Well, water, for one. So when you want to do crewed missions or any kind of missions, water is an essential component for humans, of course, in terms of the oxygen and the water, but mm-hmm. also fuel. So hydrogen is the base for rocket fuel, amongst other possibilities. So by having, for crewed exploration in particular, so for example, the 3 tons of water are required for the 7-month trip for the 4 Mars One candidates to go to Mars. So this is some tons of water just for 4 people to do a kind of couple of
trip. And you get that from asteroids?
Yes. So. Okay. Volatiles like water and other substances like that are found on asteroids. The metals that you would need for the 3D printing of different infrastructures. Basically, an asteroid is also a good way to study the origins of the solar system. It's a collection of the same kind of stuff, the star stuff, from which Earth was created. Except on Earth, all the metals have mostly gone to the core. So if we do require them, it would be natural to look for them elsewhere.
They used to say, certainly when I learned about the structure of our solar system, that the asteroid belt might have been a planet or a moon or something that was smashed to pieces.
Yeah, there's a theory like that, and I think I watched it on Ancient Aliens, so I won't talk about it in too much
detail. No, I mean, that's not
a possibility.
It won't get carried away, but it's between Mars and Jupiter,
yeah.
Right?
So there's a theory that there was another planet there, and it's smashed into Mars, because what we see on one hemisphere of Mars is kind of an indentation. It's not perfectly spherical. And what kind of force would have been required, or what kind of event would have caused such an indentation, could have been a massive impact, maybe one that's like spread the kind of rocks like this one that I brought here today to planet Earth, and the debris in the belt between those two could be remnants of that planet, I think. But this is a fascinating theory, and we would be able to find out more evidence for this by investigating asteroids. We haven't really done so at the moment. JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, and NASA have missions en route to rendezvous and physically extract samples from 2 asteroids. They'll be back in the early 2020s, and depending on what kind of distribution of metals and so on they find, again, these are only just 2 asteroids, so not really representative of the body in general. But I think this may stimulate business to say, okay, we have some valuable metals out there, and given that we're now paying $10 billion to fund a mine, it takes around 10 10 years from the start to the finish of the mine. This is not too different to the cost and the time frame estimated for asteroid mining. So there was a study in Keck Institute of Space Science a few years ago, and they estimated these costs are a ballpark $10 billion in around 10 years to retrieve an asteroid into low Earth orbit. So I think it's time for us to, you know, move to the next sphere
retrieve
of activity.
Retrieve the asteroid.
Yes, so a small one.
We'd bring it here.
Whatever size you would want, you can find it out there. There's plenty of asteroids, most of them not characterized. Mm. So the prospecting would, of course, be an important aspect of the mission to
That's the asteroid we want.
Which one do we want?
You say we'd keep it in a low Earth orbit.
So there's a mission design by a friend of mine, Dr. Bruce Damer, and others who open sourced this mission design for retrieving asteroids that involves encapsulation. So instead of landing on the asteroid or harnessing the asteroid somehow, because this wouldn't be a good way to do it in many cases, as asteroids are loosely consolidated piles of rubble. In mm-hmm. many cases, so the debris would both harm your infrastructure and your craft, and also make it impossible to catch it all once you touch it, it keeps mm-hmm. going out and forever. So to encapsulate it would be a good way, or this is in this proposal at least, and then to use to extract the resources from it while it's encapsulated. And if you do real-time analytics on the different metals and whatever that you're extracting, you can determine cost feasibility at any moment and whether or not this is the one you want. Maybe you choose to abort and take a different one. There are plenty of asteroids out there, I think, and given that we understand, this takes us back to the argument about inanimate versus animate matter. I think these asteroids are inanimate matter. I mean, we'd, of course, do a scan to look for life on them. First, we could. It's part of the science. But to the extent to which I find this ethical is that these are rocks. Mm-hmm. If we're mining on Earth, we are disrupting animate matter, which, as we've said, we don't understand well. So I think we'd best protect and respect our unique biosphere here on the surface of Earth, and perhaps extracting rocks from space will provide us with the resources to sustain ourselves on Earth, and also for the crewed exploration that we're really excited to be hopefully heralding by this industry in the next few decades.
Look, I think we're going to have to do a part three of this eventually. It's good to talk to you. And I hope that by 2018 or 2019, we have made some of those major breakthroughs that you spoke about earlier, that we have these aha moments, these leapfrog things that are likely to occur, because we do have, with collaboration and increased ways of coagulating useful data and all the rest of it, there are ways now that we can figure out answers to complex questions in much shorter spaces of time, right?
Yeah, definitely. A quantum computer would be amazing as well. Let's hold thumbs for IBM.
Well, the way you get excited about this stuff makes me excited. So it's a pleasure to speak to you again, Adriana.
It was a pleasure to be here, Gareth.
Cool.
Thank you.
We'll see you soon.
Yeah.
Look after that Mars rock.
Well, it's going back to its cupboard now.
All right. Thank you, Adriana Moreira, everybody. And a quick look at what's been going on with not only her plans on getting out there into space, but all the things that are attached to that she's very, very hard at work trying to pursue. And I think that these are the things that make humans superhumans, not the stuff that you see in Marvel cartoons or in those superhero movies. This is the stuff of reality that we're just starting to scratch the surface of understanding in some ways. It's very, very exciting. Thank you, Adriana.
This is CliffCentral.com.